Welcome to the podcast, the only podcast you need. It's been a while. How are you doing? My name's Danny McCrum. On the show today, we have Anthony Tonon. Anthony is a singer-songwriter who's about to embark on a national tour of New Zealand. The tour is called Leave Love Out of This. It begins on May 6th, which is the very date this episode comes out. It goes from May 6th to May 21st. He's going to be playing 5 dates across the country. He's released a number of new songs in the last year, including his latest single, Lockheed Bomber. You can check out his music and buy tickets at anthonytonon.com. That's A-N-T-H-O-N-I-E-T-O-N-N-O-N.com. Today's show is brought to you by a new sponsor, Transcribe Plus. Transcribe Plus is a slow downer and pitch shifting app that helps you learn any piece of music by ear. Create loops or drag on the wave itself to listen note by note. It has all the features you'd expect and more, like custom EQ, mono toggle, and video support. Transcribe Plus also uses machine learning to isolate or remove elements from any song you own. Remove or isolate vocals, drums, bass, or any other accompanying instruments. I have a link here which is kind of awkward to say. It's /apple.co/36IEHSU. That's awkward. So we'll post it on the website, and we'll post it on Facebook, and we'll post it around. But I believe you can go to the App Store or go to the Apple Shop or what. I'm forgetting what everything's called. But go there and put in Transcribe followed by the plus symbol, and you'll find the app. In other news, next week on May 14th, I'm going to be a guest speaker at New Zealand's first podcast summit, brought to you by Lewis Tennant. Lewis has been working his ass off on the summit, and it's going to be a really interesting day. I'm going to be on a panel of three, speaking at about, I think, 11 o'clock, 11:30 possibly a.m., and we're going to be talking all things podcast. Each panel has a different couple of subjects they're going to cover. Lewis has asked me to talk about the technical side of putting a podcast together, which is kind of funny to me because I don't know the technical side of putting a podcast together. I am, like a lot of musicians my age, I'm a musician who kind of learned how to do some engineering and kind of knows how to do things if you push a few buttons and get a few things wrong and then figure it out and maybe ring someone. But I'm going to be talking about the technical side of recording a podcast. And I probably have something to offer, I guess, because there are a lot of people recording podcasts who don't know anything about recording audio at all. And so I guess just having a bit of experience in music will help me with that. But more or less, I'm going to be winging it. I'm going to be faking it until I make it. I'm going to be making answers up and hoping that charm and humor cover for my inadequacies. I should also say, if you value the work we do here, please consider going to our website and hitting the donate button. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to us on YouTube. It always means a lot to us when we get support. It really helps us keep this thing going. So thank you in advance. I'm firing through the subjects here so I can kind of get this done and we can get to the interview. We've been doing this artist search thing recently, which has actually been going surprisingly well. It's been fascinating receiving music from all over the country, from people, you know, writing in, sending links to SoundCloud accounts and things like that, Bandcamp. It's great. It's been really interesting. I've received music from so many different genres, and it's awesome. And so today, at the end of the episode, we're going to be playing our second choice. Not second place, just our second selection. There's no competition here. There's no ranking. There are no winners. We're just playing stuff we listen to and we think that's cool. No agenda beyond that, except we want it to be more interesting than the predictable 1, 4, 5, 6 pop stuff that's getting through at the moment. So stay tuned at the end of the show and check out today's selection. Right, I think I did it. I got through it. I think I ticked off all of the things I had to say, which means I can now bring to you my conversation with Anthony Tonon.
Now let's do this!
Nice mic, by the way.
I know. Yeah. It's become a cliche now, hasn't it? And everyone mentions Joe Rogan and it's just like, oh God.
No, they're just the greatest mics. They just are.
Yeah, very versatile. I find them very good for vocal takes because you don't need to prepare the room so much.
Right.
Like you do with a condenser.
I love them on my voice. They pick up the kind of the subtleties in that mid to high range, you know, so you can really hear the breath. And you know, I think it obviously depends on the voice. You've got quite a different voice than me.
Yeah.
Do you like your voice on these, or do you prefer?
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah. Pretty much. There's one little bit around an but that doesn't sound good. But
is that a technical term?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I tend to use on the last album. I tended to use this or an RE20,
right?
Which is another radio mic, sort of designed for broadcast.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, isn't it? Because I actually prefer this on my voice than the $20,000, you know, studio mics.
Yeah, and all the setting, it's the setting up. It's the setting up that's the terrible thing.
Right.
You know, setting up the middle room and like making the booth with pillows. And, and then you find out that you're not even ready to do the vocal take.
Right.
You know, because you haven't sung the song enough, you know.
I like it how your talking voice is similar to your singing voice in the sense that it does sound like you. I get the comment that people hear me talk and they go, what? That's, but you don't sing, you, what?
And yeah.
To me it sounds funny, like you're about to start the song because it's the same voice. I think that's more a reflection on how strange my voice is when I go to sing.
I don't know, it's funny, isn't it? Like, I was just reading something the other day about how, you know, when you talk, you do talk with notes
yes.
to a certain degree. And I'm a little bit blurry on the line between percussive spoken sound and notes. So that was interesting to me. I think a lot of people sing in their head voice but talk in their chest voice. That's very common,
right?
And I tend to do that, although more and more I'm talking singing in my chest voice.
And
I don't know, you get better at writing for your voice over time, and maybe it's becoming, maybe I'm moving a little bit closer to my talking voice for that reason.
I think you're right about that last statement, because I think in the past I made the mistake of trying to sound like people I was a fan of, and I'd be therefore, I'd sing in the wrong range for my voice. I'd be trying to emulate someone who just had a completely different voice.
Right.
And then I'd be often missing, you know, because I couldn't get that high, or I didn't have my voice didn't break up the same way or whatever. And I think I am getting better at using what I've got more, you know, and writing for my voice more. That must just be experience where you learn that. I mean, I don't know if you have the same kind of story in that respect, because, and this is a compliment, when I hear your vocal performances, it sounds like you're just comfortable in your own skin.
It's funny. If I listen to myself 10 years ago, it's quite different.
Right.
And it's maybe I was a little bit more consciously trying to sing in my own voice rather than not having to think about it too much. I mean, I made a bit of an effort. I mean, there was a time earlier than that that I was, you know, singing in an American accent. And, you know, as you do, like that's the way you grow up singing in Aotearoa. But I made a kind of conscious effort to change those things,
right,
which could come out a bit forced at first. I mean, also, I listened back to my voice from the early EPs that we did, and I can really hear Dunedin in there, you know, holes,
right?
And U's instead of I's, and you know, 7 years in Auckland kind of straightened my voice out a little bit and smoothed some of the rough edges, so that I could talk in polite society. Possibly now, living in Whanganui, it's actually becoming a little bit more regional again.
Right.
But in a sort of new way.
So you were, what, somewhat feral in the past? Is that what you're saying? Or like the multicultural aspect of Auckland opened you up?
Well, yeah, I guess a Dunedin accent can be quite abrasive to an Aucklander, for sure.
Can you demonstrate? Can you break into your Dunedin accent?
I just remember one time doing a session for BFM, and the producer saying, I noticed you say hulls instead of hills.
I wonder where that came from. I wonder why that is. Because Dunedin's very kind of Irish, isn't it? Like Irish immigrant.
Scottish, yeah.
Oh, it's more Scottish, is it?
Yeah. There was a big Irish community actually in Caversham,
right.
Which is a neighborhood of Dunedin.
Yeah.
But yeah, sort of, it was set up as a free church settlement for the Church of Scotland.
Right.
Not the Church of Scotland. Free church settlement. Scottish. And, you know, I've got some family that go back to that.
But do you think this is playing into the accent down there, or is this unrelated?
I don't know. I think, you know, like, there's gradations. I actually think New Zealand would be a really interesting source of research for accents, particularly in the 21st century. I mean, I talked to my grandma, and she says that when she first left Otago, her accent was very noticeable to people, and the changes in accent as she got to Wellington, or she went to Gisborne on a nursing training, were very noticeable.
Right.
And, you know, like, the simple answer about accents in New Zealand is that as you get further into the regions, it becomes a little bit more laconic, maybe more exaggerated in terms of the vowels and the way that we do a cliched New Zealand accent.
Yeah.
But the thing that I find unusual is I travel around the country and I meet people with the same weird subset of accent, but in different towns.
Right. So it's like it's evolved separately in different places. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I don't know. Or maybe it's maybe it's lots of migration in the late 20th century, and people have got their parents' accent, but they, you know, they've that means it's been able to spread between Te Aratu and Corstorphine, and Lincoln. You know, so we don't have those huge noticeable gradations in accent that you get in the UK, but. Mm. I think it's good when you do, like, here in Whanganui, there's this really interesting accent you find when you meet people who have family that goes back here a while,
yeah.
And it's actually quite English.
Oh,
it's quite
right.
Proper.
Yeah.
Here in New Plymouth, and I just can only put that down to a bit of isolation of some of the farmers that lived here and maybe didn't get to see that many more people for a couple of generations.
Yeah, because my assumption's always been that the rest of New Zealand had the accent, and it was only the, you know, Auckland and Wellington, basically the big cities, that had become softened. The accent had been softened just because we were mixed up with different people from different parts of the world or whatever. I just always assumed that was the case.
Maybe it's the case, but then you find some pretty strong accents within Auckland as well, I'd say.
But I remember, I mean, my grandparents were both very well spoken. Both sides were very well spoken as well. My nana was that classic nana who corrected me all the time, and you know, which was kind of good. I didn't necessarily take it all on board, but she was New Zealand born and raised, but you know, I assume her mum must have been English, I guess.
Yeah.
It just seemed to be that our accent was very English not that long ago.
Right, yeah.
And the other funny thing that I've always thought about is that when I was growing up, and I grew up in Auckland, a lot of the modern slang that we use and we think of as being Kiwi slang just wasn't in my life, and I don't know why.
Right.
Like, I never say the word mate because it feels weird to me, because no one said mate when I was a kid.
Okay, interesting.
And I don't know what, was I in some weird little bubble or something? Or was this just, has our kind of Kiwi words, have they become more of a thing in the last, you know, couple of decades or something? I can't figure it out.
Yeah, I noticed when I moved from Dunedin to Auckland that I spoke more like that than Aucklanders. And if anything, Aucklanders found it a little bit abrasive. they weren't used to kind of... that classic laconic kind of New Zealand accent and vernacular.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I got to say, I find it's abrasive sometimes. Like, it depends who's doing it. If I think of the typical, like, mate kind of guy, that usually, it's usually the guy, though, that winds me up, and the mate is just the icing.
Yeah.
But
But
a lot of the local slang is just, you don't even notice it because it just sounds like... Yeah. In fact, you notice it more when you go overseas and then you come back and you go, oh my God.
Yeah. True.
I get the impression from you that you're, I can't quite decide if you are putting together a kind of a personality or a theme around your persona as an artist in your music, or if it's something that's more organic and I'm assuming that it's more put together. But it does seem to be different to the usual status quo in New Zealand. And I'm curious to know whether that is a conscious move, if that's like a branding exercise, or if that's how you've always felt and it's just who you are.
Yeah, I guess I do, particularly when I play live.
Mm.
I do have a personality that I walk into. Mm-hmm. It's somebody that's able to speak a little bit more clearly and succinctly, and you know, I tend to dramaturg my shows to figure out when there's going to be you know, a monologue or when I'm going to speak and maybe what themes I'm going to speak on between songs,
right.
And to try to get those to be as effective as possible. I guess when I started out in Dunedin, we were quite anti artifice,
mm-hmm.
in Dunedin, back in the late 2000s, early 2010s, the community that I sort of came from. So I used to just, you know, wear jeans and a t-shirt and, you know, just play in whatever I was in at the time.
Yeah.
And, didn't have any effects pedals and tried to just be
like pure
me.
Organic.
But when I moved to Auckland in 2010, over time I picked up a lot more about aesthetics. I was hanging out with people from Elam and going to art gallery openings on Friday nights, and I grew to love the way that Aucklanders dressed in things that fit them, rather than just whatever was at the op shop, and I started to appreciate the aesthetic, you know, the value of adding aesthetics, of adding drama, of adding theatricality to a show, and then you know, when I had to switch from playing in a band to touring solo, I no longer had the band to create the dynamism on stage or to communicate with on stage. And so I had to communicate more powerfully with the audience to be able to get the same effect.
Yep.
And so I just started developing that personality that could do that.
Mm.
And to do that, it takes a lot of preparation as well.
Yeah. I respect it though. I think it's a really professional move. And I remember having a conversation with a musician I worked with many, many years ago. And he was, in his mind, he was very kind of organic and pure and so on. And he didn't want to know about any of it. He wasn't interested in dressing up or photos or branding, or he didn't want to know about any of it. And I remember making the point to him that no matter what you wear, people will see you however they see you. So,
yeah,
and he was the kind of guy who would just throw on whatever was clean and just, you know, he had none of his clothes matched and he had sort of no style or personality about him or anything. And people just judged him that way. They just saw this guy that they, I don't know how they judged him, but I was trying to explain to him, however you present yourself, they're going to take you that way. They don't know who you are, you know? And if that's how you want to be taken, then that's how you need to look. But if you want to be taken differently, you need to look like that. And I do flinch a little bit sometimes at the classic Kiwi thing where the musician turns up in shorts and jandals and some old t-shirt and plays a gig. I think, really, do you actually care about what you're doing, or, you know? So I'm fully with you. I reckon it's presentation.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. It's a decision whether you make the decision or not. I mean, at the same time, you know, it was amazing when, you know, watching... you know, Marlon Williams over the years, you know, when he transitioned out of his bolo ties and his and his big hat and started turning up in a white singlet, and because that was a conscious choice.
Right. I'm not sure if I'm up to date with that move. I still remember him in his hat.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've known Marlon for a long time. And
yeah.
He, around the time of the... first or second album, he stopped wearing the costume that you associate with country music and started dressing in a very different way. And I loved it because it signaled something different. It signaled that he was more than, I guess, a pastiche, you know.
But you could argue, though, that he had also, you know, by then he had kind of established himself. People had an idea of who he was. And so now he's just going into phase two. Do you know what I mean? If it started in the singlet, maybe it wouldn't have worked.
Perhaps, yeah.
I always remember thinking in the 90s that this is such a random segue, but Michael Jackson released the Dangerous album. I think it was the Dangerous album? No, I might have that wrong. Whatever he did in the mid 90s, and he did that stupid music video with that giant statue of himself, and it was all so convoluted right. and ridiculous. And I remember at the time thinking that whole kind of, you know, Michael Jackson as the king of pop thing was working really well in the 80s, but it just didn't land in the 90s. And I remember thinking, like, he just needs to turn up in jeans and a t-shirt and dance like a motherfucker. You know, like, that's all he needs to do. That's really all anyone right. wants him to do is sing and dance and do his thing in just a t-shirt, you know? What worked in the 80s worked in the 80s. He just needed to respond for the 90s. And you know, for whatever reason, that's not what happened. But that's how I always saw it. And if he had cut, but, you know, you have to also give him credit because the whole thing he did in developing this personality and all the visuals and everything made him who he was, and, you know, as well as obviously the music.
Yeah. The 90s was a real time for jeans and a t-shirt and also no reverb as well. I toured with a friend who was playing in the 90s, and he hates reverb. He just people who were making music in the 90s had a real reaction to the overuse of reverb in the 80s.
I'm old enough that I was playing in the 90s, and I don't remember that. I love reverb.
Right.
Yeah. That must have been some niche somewhere. But that's the funny thing about the 90s is that these decades get remembered for a certain, you know, a limited amount of themselves. But when you're actually in the decade, it's just a mess of all sorts of things, you know? And when I think of the 90s, I also think of, like, Radiohead, and I think of, I don't know, heaps of stuff that was all really vibey and verby and so on.
Sure, sure.
So you were talking about before when you were working with a band and then you broke away and started doing your own thing. How did that unfold? Was that something that kind of blew up on you, or was that a decision that you made to transition?
No, it was simply practical. We toured the Successor album in 2015, and then I'd been doing a little bit of touring overseas. I'd done maybe one tour in the States at that time, and a tour in Australia.
Where in the States did you go?
I went right across with a friend, Shenandoah Davis.
Mm-hmm. Bible Belt, like LA to New Orleans sort of thing? Or
yeah, we would. I've tended to do the two coasts and then the Midwest.
Yeah.
As opposed to the South. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to do more touring overseas. Mm. And it just wasn't practical to do it as a band, but I also didn't want to create a lesser show,
right?
As a solo performer, and so I started. I mean, I started by upping that theatricality in my set, and I started doing things like audience interaction and just trying to break people out of the normal. Kind of routine of a show,
right. Yeah.
To disrupt those things and surprise people. Mm. But then I also wanted sonically to do more as well, and so I started experimenting with technology a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I learned to build a VHS cassette tape matrix mixer at the musical electronics library in the Parisian Tires building in Auckland.
You're going to have to explain what that is. I don't know what you just said.
It's a very simple mixer. You get a VHS cassette tape and you have four inputs and four outputs.
Right.
And it means that everything you put into the four inputs can then go to any one or all of the four outputs.
Right.
Okay. And it's completely passive as well. So it's doesn't need power or anything. And
what does it achieve? What does it do?
Well, for me, it allowed me to connect up a big home keyboard, mm-hmm. a bunch of guitar pedals, and a drum machine app, and start blending them all together.
Right.
I was listening to Arthur Russell at the time, and I loved how his songs would start as folk songs, or his album would start as what sounded like a folk album with the cello, and then all of a sudden it would become this kind of not totally in time, housey mess.
Right.
And so I started adding in kind of elements where the set would change and suddenly become this thing that you could potentially dance to, and I would dance to it. And I had a lot of fun rebuilding songs that had been written for solo or for a band, but adding these electronic elements in. And I developed over many tours, lots of trips to Australia, lots of touring regional New Zealand, and playing to very small crowds, and then playing in dive bars in America to, you know, wine cellar sort of size crowds, and having to learn how to communicate the same thing to different audiences, and finding a way to read people and get the message across, even despite kind of the lack of context,
right?
That you might have when you're playing to people who know your music scene.
And how did you find the audiences were taking it? You know, especially when you're being more experimental and trying different things. I mean, it's great to do that on an artistic level, but it can be tough out there, can't it, on a gigging circuit when you're not doing the sort of the standard.
Oh well, it was actually simply that the standard wasn't working for me.
Right.
When I first started doing these shows, something wasn't landing, and I was just turning up and playing the songs in the first instance.
Right.
And I found that if I experimented and if I tried different things, and you know, I did three tours of the States where I sort of had 30 shows, and so you're doing this night after night. I couldn't do this now, but I would make myself do a different set list every single night.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Like with exactly the same songs in a different order, or also swapping songs out?
Well, I would have a set of 15, 16 songs or so.
Yeah.
And every night it might be, I'd play 12 of them, but I'd play a different set.
And what was the reasoning? Was that just to try and keep yourself fresh or something, or...?
Yeah, it was a lesson in reading. It was reading the audience and reading the possibilities.
Yeah.
I guess you can do that as a solo performer, because it's only you that has to change the song. It's a little bit harder with a band. The Bruce Springsteen does it. He always calls out the set list.
Yeah.
Which to me is just crazy.
I know lots of bands do it. I used to do the same thing as well. And you're right, because you can read the room and go, oh, they're responding to the more rocky stuff or the more funky stuff or whatever, and then go that way. But it takes out the pacing, you know, like when you have a written show and you get a feel for this is the sort of the dynamic arc of the show, and this is, you know, this is the moment, like you said earlier, you can plan when you're going to say something, or, you know, you kind of sacrifice all of that.
Yeah, well, I would watch the, that's what the opening act's for.
Right.
You have to find a place and sit the back of the crowd and watch the opening act and write your set list, because you get a chance to read the crowd as they're watching the opening act as well.
Right.
But gosh, I put a lot of pressure on myself, and I I came out a much better performer than I had started. And I didn't realize it at the time, but that was the main thing I was going to get out of the touring in the States, was to become a greater performer.
Did you have any gigs that just went completely pear-shaped?
Oh, lots of them, yeah.
Yeah, what kind of pear-shaped?
I can't remember now, but I mean, a lot of the time it was just that thing where you try something and it connected for an audience before, and then it didn't connect anymore.
Yep.
One of the things I noticed was that I noticed the cycle as well, that you try, your set isn't working, so you change something and you try it and it doesn't perfectly work, but you think there's something in it. Then three shows later, it's working really, really well. And it's become a great trick in your set.
Yeah.
But then three sets after that, or maybe it's like 10, 10 performances later, you can no longer use it because you don't believe it anymore. It's not fresh enough to you anymore.
That's kind of a pain in the ass though, don't you think? Like, because I have that problem as well. Like sometimes with my guitar playing, I have that problem where I get bored with my own ideas, and then I try to do something else, and now I'm trying to play outside of the area I'm actually good at. So, like, you know what I mean? Like, sometimes you just have to go, it's for them, not you. You know, you have to, you know, give the show to them.
Yeah, yeah. Although, you know, your mind is sending you a signal when you get bored with something, I think, too. And sometimes it's as simple as resting that song for a while.
Yeah.
To take it out of the set list.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of what I did when I was changing the set list every night. I was saying, look, I'm losing the thing, and I need to put this away for a couple of days. And you know, like at that time as well, I guess I had a couple of songs that could feel really amazing when they were done well.
Right.
You know, and that kind of, I had a song, Sugar in the Petrol Tank, which is on Successor, which it requires kind of heightened awareness and intensity to play it, to make it feel beautiful, you know?
Right. Yep.
Making something beautiful is really hard when you know how to play it.
Yeah.
What I noticed at one point is that I was starting to play it on autopilot, and once you get good at playing the songs, you can leave your body and then start thinking about how many people are in the audience, thinking about you know,
looking at people's outfits or thinking about what you had for dinner or that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, like how far am I going to drive tonight before I choose a cheap motel? you know, and when you do that, then you start to lose the ability to make that song transcendent, you know?
Yeah.
And so I did a lot of, I started doing something where I like would put my hands up in the air and I would make people chant with me like I'm, like, what's that movie with the news anchor? Says I'm not going to take it anymore. You know, like I was having a kind of early midlife crisis or something.
Right.
And these things would kind of surprise the audience, but they would also surprise me, and they would kind of shock me out of that autopilot.
Yeah.
And then I would play the songs in a different way. I mean, I don't use the same tricks now. I mean, it's funny, like I had a real theatrical stage, and then I had a very electronic stage, which I guess I'm still in. But at a certain point as well, I had all this theatrical stuff, and then I toured Europe with Nadia Reid, and all of the tricks and stuff were just working great in the UK. And they were working fine in the Netherlands, you know, getting people to sing along, getting people to clap along, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I got to Germany and it just didn't work at all. Like, you know, you say to a German crowd, okay, you're going to sing with me. And you know, when you say these things very forcefully and you look at the crowd with your eyes and you don't, like, prevaricate about getting them to sing with you in New Zealand or UK or even the States, you can get people to sing along with you, but in Germany it just doesn't work. They just don't do it.
Yeah.
They'll just kind of cross their arms and then politely clap at the end of the song. And so that was a failure for me. I had a few shows that kind of bombed and when I was supporting Nadia in Germany. And I had to rethink it, and I was like, well, how am I going to be able to play to a mindset that's different and it isn't as outward,
right?
As say the Dutch or the British mindset, of a crowd, and so that's when I started incorporating a lot more movement and dance, and so that I could create those kinds of interventions that would shake things out for me, but. And would disrupt what the audience was expecting, but it wouldn't necessarily depend on those kinds of theatrical gags or the you know, an actual verbal communication between the audience and.
Because I heard someone once make the point that the luxury a musician has is if they're playing their song and it's not landing very well, they can just finish the song and walk off the stage. But the far more dangerous thing to do is stand-up comedy, because, you know, you need the laughter, otherwise it's really obviously not working, you know? And comedians talk about dying on stage for that reason. And it's true, as a musician, we can just ride the set out. I mean, maybe the problem for you is that you had those improv moments that were actually relying on the audience response. And if you didn't get the response, then it was quite obviously not landing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah. I mean, I at that time I was taking a lot of influence from stand-up comedy as well.
Hmm.
It's a beautiful form when it's done right.
It's amazing.
Well, not right. Who knows what right is, but when it's done well. Also love that they get to, I mean, their advantage is they get to just be up there with a microphone. You know, I'm forever trying to figure out how I can get my touring set up lighter. But
yeah, that's right.
No matter how many pieces of gear I buy to make the set lighter, some reason my luggage gets larger.
And so speaking of luggage, I was watching the song Peacetime Orders, which is a beautiful song. And I couldn't quite see what kind of guitar you were playing. Was it a Yamaha or a Gretsch or...
It's a Yamaha, yeah, an SA-12, 1968.
Wow, 1968?
Yeah.
Like a reissue or actually a classic?
No, it's the real thing.
Wow.
And when I say the real thing, I mean it was a cheap knockoff kind of guitar, knockoff of a Gretsch made by Yamaha in the 60s, targeted at kind of gigging, you know, jazz players. It's got very little... You know, it's like in Spinal Tap. It's the reverse of that. It's got no sustain whatsoever.
Right.
I have to give it lots of, have to have
a vibrato,
a little bit of delay and lots of vibrato and a good reverb.
Yeah. Well, it looks like it's spanking new in the video. You must have polished it up good.
I mean, guitars are amazing things, and you know, like I guess the pillars for me. Sonically is and performatively is, you know, I'm really interested in technology, and I'm now using two synth strum deluges on stage, and I've got a bunch of 1980s stuff, but you know, so I love electronic music, and I'm no longer the technophobe I was when I was in Dunedin, but having a 1968 guitar that's a real stringed instrument and has been built, you know, by a luthier of some sort. Mm. It adds an organic pillar to the sound.
Yeah,
and you know, I just think it's amazing. You know that you know, having a guitar like that is as close as we get today as to having a Stradivarius. You know,
yeah.
It's amazing to think that, and it might have been, you know, 68, you know, mid 70s might have been the last time that you could get a guitar that probably won't age too badly even in the next 100 years.
Yeah, that's right.
And the more I play it, you know, and touch wood, the more I play it, it seems to sound better too. It seems to just get better. And it is funny because there were a lot of these particular Yamaha guitars, this model and a couple of models after it, that made their way to Japan, as to Australia and New Zealand, in particular. You don't see them so much in the US.
Mm.
And you know, I've played some that haven't been played for 10 years, and they don't sound very good.
Right.
So I was just lucky that, you know, someone had been playing it, and it got in the hands of Jonathan Pierce, my producer, and he was playing guitar for us. And Tono in the finance company, and he was playing that guitar.
Yeah.
I used it to record an album with him, and I just, the guitar chose me, and decided that I was going to be the person to play it. And I was never comfortable I was never that comfortable on a guitar until that particular guitar came along.
Interesting. So you don't think of yourself as a guitar player then?
I perhaps do now. I think I'm a good rhythm guitarist, and I've earned that over a long period of time. But it did take, you know, having the right guitar. It's funny. When I moved to Auckland, I was pretty poor, and so first thing I did, well, after about a month or two, I started selling all my musical equipment.
Been there
to keep being a musician.
Yep.
And one of the things I worked out is that you could have a guitarist, and then you didn't need to own a guitar anymore. And so I became a front person.
Right.
And had to learn how to be a front person, and then Jonathan did the guitaring.
Yeah.
But eventually I bought the guitar off Jonathan.
Well, there's something really nice about the combination of the electronic side of the music with the organic guitar. And you know, I mean, you hear a lot of stuff that's purely electronic, and some of it's cool and some of it's a bit blasé, you know. But there's something really moody about the way that you marry the two together. And I don't know whether that was something that you did for more for practical reasons at first. It kind of sounds like, you know, the band was too much and too expensive and too big a deal to constantly keep going. Although I believe you're back with the band on this upcoming tour, right?
Mm.
So did you kind of trip over your sound through for pragmatic reasons? Or was this like, was it an artistic decision? I want to marry these two sounds together.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I guess the philosophy on this album was that to make a great album, you want to develop what is going to be the recording and the arrangements as you're playing.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in playing, playing being the production for the album. And, you know, the process with the album was to, I would have a song, I would be, the thing that would drive me to finish the song is so that I had something new to play in the set.
Yep.
Then I would go back to Jonathan and show him what I had to start recording it. We might put something down, but then I'd go away on tour again and I'd come back and I'd go, you know what, actually I can play this better now because this works live.
Right.
And that's the ultimate test, you know, if you can test your arrangements and your performances live, then you can be sure that it works.
Yep.
You know, especially when you're doing things like using synth patches and things like trying to think up synth patches on the fly in the studio. It's just endless. It's like, well, this low pass filter could be set at 50 or it could be set at 35. It could be anywhere.
Yeah.
And you just don't know what is right.
Right.
But if you go and play 10 shows, by the end of that, you will know what the synth patch needs to be.
And it's the same in terms of arrangement and dynamics, right? I mean, how many great albums have come out of bands that have actually toured the album before they've recorded it? And it just changes.
Yeah, I mean,
it changes the whole thing.
Absolutely. And I mean, you can do it the other way too. And I've done it the other way, and it can have its own magic.
Yeah.
But I always found that when you make an album quickly, when you then go away to tour it, a couple of the songs, you will end up changing the arrangement,
right?
And the arrangement will become better.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that. I wanted the best arrangement for all these songs.
Yeah.
Quite stubbornly, and so a lot of these songs changed and morphed through playing.
Mm.
And yeah, that was just the sound that developed. That was the tools that I had. I had a drum. You know, the Deluge allows me to have a drum machine and synthesizers going at the same time. And I mean, I had rules like I didn't sequence more than I could tangibly have control of.
Right.
On stage, so that people could see me controlling and morphing it.
Yeah.
So
this isn't, I mean, you've pretty much made this clear, but this isn't backing tracks, is it? I mean, you're actually building the sounds as you go, so you can improvise and change the arrangements as you go, right?
Yes and no. Yes, and that, as I say, the rule is that I have to be in control of everything.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's also not building loops,
right?
Because I wanted to be in control of everything. I also didn't want to take the looping approach, which is a great approach, and but I wanted to try something different. And what I started with the philosophy of the drum machine. You know, if you look at the way sequencing on an 808 works, you've got 16 buttons, and then the cursor is just moving past those 16 buttons.
Mm-hmm.
Over and over again, and you can choose the snare, and you can put it on 4 and 8.
Yeah.
And it'll keep going around, and you can be additive in that way. So I treated sequencing as an instrument in itself.
Mm.
You know, start the drum machine, put the things where they need to be in that drum machine, and I felt there were some times when I could say, press a button and make a whole bunch of music happen,
yep,
and not have to be like playing five instruments to show that sound was being played by a human. And in fact, sometimes there are moments when you can just press a button and make music happen. And then that gives you an opportunity to do something else. And that's right. when I started, and I figured if I'm going to press a button, I'm going to make it the greatest button push I've ever done, you know? and that's where you can use movement and be very theatrical, or sometimes, you know, you can use dance.
Yeah.
It's like if you've freed up your hands with technology, then what else can you do with them?
Right, yeah. And is this approach also, because I noticed a couple of the songs, that, well, at least the last two songs I listened to, were over 6 minutes long. And I often make the argument on the podcast that in the old industry, we always felt the pressure, you know, for all songs to be 3 minutes 30 or less, because we're always thinking about singles and radio and record companies and blah, blah, blah. But now that everything seems to have changed and none of that stuff seems to matter as much anymore, now we're freer, I think, as artists, to just go, I want my song to be 25 minutes long, and if you don't like it, don't listen to it, you know? I mean, is there kind of that going on in your head a little bit on this?
It's maybe just something that happened from that live focus.
Yeah.
I guess 6 minutes is not ideal for a single, but it's great live.
Mm.
Live, that can be fantastic. And, you know, like Peacetime Waters is a good example.
Yeah.
It was just a guitar. It was just a guitar ballad, you know, with a finger-picking pattern initially. But playing it live, it just... I felt there was something more in there. And then I found that kind of, like, fugue-like pattern on the synthesizer at the end, and it turned into this ridiculous kind of side-chained house thing.
Yeah.
And those are the kinds of morphs and surprising evolutions that can happen live. And
right.
you couldn't make them from scratch sitting in a studio, I don't think. Not in the same, or I wouldn't have made the same thing happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely. I guess that approach, that kind of linear, additive, drum machine influenced approach to building sound, there is a tendency to drive you towards longer and longer songs.
But why not? If it works, it works.
No. I like it, you know.
So you've gone out live, you've played the songs are developed, and your arrangement has sort of landed the way that it's landed. You then go to the studio to make the, you know, proper recording version. Do you now just remember the arrangement that you've evolved on stage and then just start playing it that way in the studio? Or have you captured recordings of gigs that you then start to reference and building it up in the studio?
Well, this is the great thing about the deluge, is that, you know, it's a New Zealand design instrument. It's a synthesizer and a drum machine, but
yeah.
It sort of looks like an Ableton Push, but you don't have to connect it to a computer.
Right.
It just works standard. It kind of is its own computer. Mm. But the great thing is that you build a show on it, or you build a song on it, and you essentially have a show file. The synth patches are all there. The drum sounds that you want are all there. It's saved. So you have I then have a head start on getting something recorded.
Right.
It's very. I can get what the deluge is doing, and then you know we recorded what I had live.
Mm.
And then, you know, then I would have drum machine, synthesizer, vocals, guitar. And then we would look for opportunities to add, you know, real drums and real bass. And then we would go back to my parts and go, well, can we beat them? Can I play them any better? And if I can't, then I would tend to try not to replace them, because, you know, I'm very superstitious about if a song is working live, don't go and change all the parts, you know, unless you're sure that you've beaten them.
Yeah.
We would start with what was on the deluge, and then we would add to it a little bit, but still the songs really sounded like what I was doing live.
Right.
And that was kind of the key architecture to them.
And I know one of the characteristics of this upcoming tour, as I mentioned before, is the fact that you're back with the band again. Has that been an exercise to get your songs converted back into band mode, or has it been relatively organic?
Yeah, it's been difficult.
Oh, is that right?
No, it's great. I mean, it just means that we're playing everything. So, but it's interesting to find the right way to do that. And it's a similar philosophy of like not including anything that I'm not in control of. So when I play solo, for example, I never have a bass line unless it's kind of, you know, the one finger left hand on a keyboard.
Yeah.
Because I don't feel that I can believably control a bass line.
Right.
While I'm also playing guitar and or you know, playing on the synthesizer. So, you know, there's one thing adding in a bass player again, but it also means, I guess, in my solo set, I can play one of the synth parts and then, but also, you know, sneak some other drone notes and other things to fill in where the other parts would be. We've got a keyboardist playing three different keyboards and fiddling with the deluges and Brooks. So she's playing all of the additional keyboard lines.
Yeah.
It's really interesting what we're doing with the drums. So a lot of these songs will start with a drum machine beat, and then we'll layer up with acoustic drums afterwards.
Right.
We did one tour a couple of years ago where it was all quite new and we didn't have much time to prepare, and so there was just a lot of waiting for Stu, our drummer, you know, waiting till it was his turn to play while the deluge played the drums.
Right.
And in this we've really taken much more of a RoboCop approach and kind of rebuilt Stu as a hybrid hybrid drum machine human drummer.
RoboCop approach. Love it. I love it how when you said that I knew what you meant as well. I was like
yeah. So you know, like if there's only electronic drums, he's playing them.
Right.
If there needs to be a section where there's going to be electronic drums and acoustic drums, he'll switch to the acoustic drums and I will trigger the deluge to take over the electronic drums. But the point is that his arms are moving all the time.
Yep.
It becomes like this magic trick. It's like you don't know where the real drumming and the digital acoustic pad drumming.
Exactly.
You know, start and finish.
Yeah. And another thing I noticed was that the stuff you write about lyrically was really surprising to me, which is great because, you know, people write kind of the same lyrics all the time usually, and yet your song Lockheed Bomber, the new single, right, that's just come out, is that right?
Yeah.
And it says it's based on the Canberra air disaster of 1940. Like, why did you write about that? It's awesome, but why? What happens to I love you and you love me and, you know, let's get married?
I've always needed a context to write in. You know, I do write love songs and I write about the same feelings that everybody else has and the same, you know, tensions and that motivate characters everywhere. But my characters always need to exist in some sort of context, be that, you know, a city or a world or a workplace or I need to be able to know what that world is that they exist in.
Right.
For this particular one, it's a character who is obsessed with planes, mm-hmm. Has a bit of money and spends all of it on this obsession, and ends up dying in an air crash. And I mean, it's a true story.
Yeah.
Although where the there's questions over, you know, who was flying the plane when,
right.
When this particular plane crashed, and the song doesn't try to answer that question. But it was at the same time, you know, like I don't, and this album was particularly hard in that I used to be able to sort of premeditate a song and know what the song was going to be about before I wrote it.
Yeah.
This song has mostly been melody or music driven.
Right.
And I've had to come to the song. I've had to come to what the lyrics are and let the music tell me what the lyrics are going to be.
Mm.
And it's interesting. It's like I don't think that lyrics are just words plus melodies for those words. I think that they're altogether another language.
Yes.
In themselves.
I agree.
And trying to work out what they are is it's like taking directions in a foreign language. And just having to guess for a while. But yeah, I was playing this riff and not knowing what it was going to be about, and it slowly developed into, you know, the image of the plane came to me, and I came across this story, this event, which I didn't know much about.
Yeah.
In fact, hadn't heard of it at all. But it fit the song, and it started to come together.
And do you find by taking that approach, because I guess some people might think that if you're writing from the point of view of a character and you're thinking of a story like that, then it's going to be less personal as a song, because surely the most personal way to write a song is just to write I'm sad and or whatever. But I remember an interview with Billy Joel where he was talking about a similar idea, that he said sometimes he'd put on a suit and go down to a restaurant and he'd play a character in real life and he'd get himself into the mindset of somebody else and then write the song. And this was the era where he wrote, I don't know if you know his stuff, but his album The Stranger is an absolute masterpiece. And it's one of the most personal and moving albums I think I've ever heard.
Right.
But he got to that by, instead of just like brain dumping, you know, going straight to the emotion, he was actually looking for stories and characters as a way of, I think, translating the emotion. I think it made it far more powerful. Is that your experience?
We need motive. We need motive. I mean, you may feel some emotions on one day, but you won't feel them the next. And it's like, well, what is your motive? What's led you to feel this?
Right.
I think songs can be just as powerful if you start with a character that isn't you, because it's much easier to establish that motive. So that's really interesting. I like that idea. I've never heard that before. Dressing up as a character.
Maybe what it achieves is, I was just thinking about it as you were talking, maybe what it achieves is that it helps you find a way of writing it that's actually going to connect with other people. Because when you're saying it, you need your motive. For a second there, I didn't know what you meant. And then I realized, like, right, it's not enough to just be sad. Why are you sad? Or whatever, you know? That's the motive, right?
Yeah.
So if you figure out what that motive is through context, character, setting, whatever, you've now also found a way of getting to the audience, you know, and how they're going to get to that emotion, right? So maybe that's what Billy Joel pulled off, because he wrote Scenes from an Italian Restaurant. He actually wrote a song literally about him sitting in the Italian restaurant.
Yeah.
But one of his most profound songs, in my opinion, is a song called Vienna. The lyrics, I don't know if I've ever listened to that song without at least goosebumps, if not tears. And
cool.
The music and the lyrics together, I don't know where the song came from, I don't know who it was for, but I don't even know why it's called Vienna, because it's not about Vienna. But there's something about it where it's just one of those songs that seems to just, I don't know, maybe it's just personal for me, it just hits me, you know? But he was the master at setting up context, and I feel like because of that, all of the songs landed more, they had more, you know, they stayed in my memory more, you know?
So sometimes that context can be light and it can be mysterious, and it can just be a few specific things in an otherwise mysterious song, but they can be the thing that makes a song relatable or feel close to someone else's experience.
And sometimes if it's more ambiguous, it's actually easier in a way to translate the emotion. I always think of this lyric from Crowded House's album Together Alone, in the most profound song called Nails in My Feet, which no one ever talks about. I don't know if anyone's ever noticed the song. I think it's probably one of Neil Finn's best songs. And it has this simple lyric that goes, I woke up the house, I stumbled in sideways, the lights went on and everyone screamed surprise. And to me, there's so much story in that, you know, and you have to hear the emotion of the melody too, of course. But the idea that this character stumbles in sideways, which implies they're out on a bender, and you kind of get the impression that the character's in a pretty bad headspace. And they've stumbled in sideways, the lights go on, everyone screams surprise. So now they're drunk and messed up facing a room full of their loved ones going, happy birthday, yeah, or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah,
and now you're in that tension going, fuck, you know. What I wanted to do was climb into a bottle of vodka, and now I have to talk to my auntie. You know, there's something really intense about that lyric, and I think he lands it perfectly by not being too specific.
Yeah, no, it's amazing when you get a much wider story and only a few lines.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got your tour starting in a week from now, which I think is going to be the exactly the day this episode comes out.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so, you know, to wrap up here, what's it been like putting a tour on in pandemic times? And dealing with all of the upside downness of the whole thing, and how has it been, you know, promoting tickets and everything, and also give everyone an outline of where you're playing and what they can expect.
Sure. It's actually been kind of interesting. I mean, we are where we are, and what I've enjoyed about it is there have now been three times that we are about to go on tour in 2 weeks, And so you get that kind of game day pressure that you can't replace with any kind of willing yourself to get ready for something. Mm. So I feel like we've been able to push the preparation for the tour further and further each time, and create a much bigger and larger show than we would have done had we been able to just do it the first time.
Yeah.
That's been kind of nice, and, you know, I've continually bought more MIDI cables and hooked up things to different places, and it's been fun to rehearse and to build something. We were really lucky that we had pretty much sold the tickets for the tour, or you know, enough of the tickets just before the Delta outbreak.
Yeah,
and so, you know, now even though we've got tickets which we'd love to sell, we always knew we were going to be able to do it, and we've been lucky that people have stuck with us. You know, obviously people have been able to get refunds in the meantime, but most people have kept their tickets.
Fantastic.
And So no, we've been really lucky. I think it's been quite hard to. It would have been much harder to have announced a tour in December or January, and tried to put it on. Now it's just because there were those months where you just don't know what's happening.
But now that everything's come back to life, have you found it difficult to find dates, like, you know, to secure the venues on dates and not clash with other things and so on?
Well, I guess, and this is the experience overseas as well, is you're kind of lucky if you already, like, I was talking to the Beths, and when they were going to the States. The only shows that venues were putting on were shows that already had most of the tickets sold already, because they could start on a dime.
Right.
They didn't need time for people to know about the show and to sell tickets. And that was us as well, because we had the show, we had enough tickets sold that we could do it. And so when we entered Orange, we were able to just say, okay, I'll tell you what, let's do the tour in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So that's been good to do.
Yeah. So you just pulled the trigger, basically. So where's the first show next week, or the day that this comes out?
Well, so if you were in Christchurch, stop what you were doing and go to Loon's. So we're playing at Loon's tonight, or Thursday the 6th of May. Yep. Sorry, Friday. Friday the 6th of May. Mm-hmm. And then we're playing two shows in Port Chalmers in Dunedin on Saturday the 7th.
Yep.
A 5 p.m. show, which still has tickets at this point, and an 8 p.m. show, which is sold out.
Fantastic.
And then we're doing the Hollywood, Avondale in Auckland the next week, Saturday the 14th, and finishing in Wellington on Friday the 20th at San Fran, and finally the Whanganui Opera House on Saturday the 21st of May.
Fantastic. Well, I wish you all the best with the tour, and thanks for being on the show, and it's been a really great chat.
Thanks so much, Danny. You too. Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. And I've got to look up that Billy Joel album.
Anthony Tonon, great chats, great story. Looking forward to seeing what he does next. Thanks, Anthony, for being on the show. And thanks to his publicist for putting that interview together. Right, now we are going to listen to our selection from the artist search. And today's song is Kicking Stones by Good Space. Their Facebook page is facebook.com/goodspacemusic. This was quirky. This was weird. I liked it straight away. It also has an awesome music video if you feel like looking it up on YouTube. Here we go. Kicking Stones by Good Space. See you soon.
Find what we're doing useful and you like this podcast, please do like, share and subscribe and give us a review on iTunes.